Great. So my name is Daniel Four, and the talk this evening, June 2017, is on working with or relating skillfully with what I'm calling, in a kind of pithy way, evil or destructive forces, really harmful and uncooperative forces in the universe. And so I am going to go through and put folks on mute so the sound quality is good, and dive right into the topic here. If folks are new then to the call, just go ahead and text your questions if you have them. So first off, what do we mean by evil? Most people, I would guess, don't even use that word and probably associate it, as I do, with a problematically moralistic and like absolute morality, as opposed to being relative about things, framework that comes out of especially Christianity, perhaps to a degree Islam or Judaism as well. And in that sense, having one source without a lot of nuance that determines what is evil and or problematic or inherently destructive and what is not, is obviously not a very skillful way to approach the topic. And yet, there are clearly some forces in the universe and that work through humans and that are humans and that take many other forms that are not rooted in love and kindness and wisdom and care for other beings. And so, even if you're rejecting of Judeo-Christian Islamic moral frameworks and things that look and feel like that, there's still some need in the way you approach reality to be able to think about and relate skillfully with these kinds of energies, right? And so the talk this evening, what I want to go through is how are some of the ways that other than Christian traditions think about this topic that I found interesting and useful, and what really doesn't work about it, so things not to do, and what are some general strategies that we can take into the subject, and then we'll hopefully have a little space for dialogue, even if it's through the chat. So let me start with what doesn't work. One thing that doesn't work is denying that such forces exist. Basically saying it's all love and light. Well, it's not all love and light. If you really think it's all love and light, you probably don't get out much or don't read the news. If folks could do me a favor, it distracts me to keep up with all the muting. And so if you know how to do that on your own, that's awesome, because otherwise I get a lot of background sound. So if you think it's all love and light, of course, you're confused, because as we're having the call, there are hundreds of thousands of children that are starving to death. There are people that are being beaten as political prisoners. And, you know, I could go through the litany of close to us and farther from us geographically, sources of doom and human suffering. And it's not, you can hold the view that that's all love and light, but that's sort of a strange, not very nuanced view. It's actually quite harmful and destructive to behave in those ways. So the damage is real. And if you deny that it's happening, you're in confusion and you can't relate skillfully with these forces. Every religious system that I've ever studied has some way of thinking and talking about these things. Another thing to not do is go into moral absolutes and make the universe into a war against good and evil. It's just kind of boring as an approach, and it's not very skillful, it's not very kind, and you end up with a split picture of yourself and at war with yourself, because we inevitably are a mirror for the world around us. And so if you say the world around you is at war, then you're saying, I accept a condition of permanent war as my identity, which is kind of unsatisfying, at least, if not really maladaptive. So don't do that. And another thing not to do is to go into total relativity about the topic, which is to say there's really no moral compass at all, and other cultures can do whatever they're going to do. All I know is what's true for me personally, and I can't really weigh in on, like, human rights is out the window because it's not our place to tell other cultures what they should do. And if, like, where this leads as a really hardened stance on the topic is that anything's theoretically okay. I mean, look at the natural world. Coyotes eat bunnies. If coyotes eat children, if coyotes eat your children. They're just eating, no problem. And ecologically, on one level, that's true. But if it's your child, you're going to be sad and upset that it's being eaten by a coyote. And so this is at least as true for human-to-human harm. And so if you go into a place of extreme relativity, you just, I would say personally, it's a cowardly stance because you're saying that what's true for me doesn't really apply to others, as if you're somehow separable from others. And so you're failing to grapple with the complexity of being part of a bigger system. So if you frame it as a choice between being in a morally absolute framework where there's just good and evil, or total relativity, you're going to make dumb choices because both of those frameworks aren't very nuanced, right? And there's another, so mostly I'm going to say a little bit about what to avoid in a really complex topic rather than presume to have an answer of the one way to handle it. A fourth thing to name as a kind of pitfall in this terrain is to just, it's a little bit different than denying that these forces exist. It's sort of like retreating into the love bunker. Like you're just in this like hold up hidden place where you just surround yourself with positivity and that's just gonna magically take care of social injustice and war and poverty in other places. And that's indicates an internal fragility to be failing. It's a failure to engage the situation. And it's a kind of abandonment. And as a strategy, the outright denial or the just hiding strategy, it's unsafe. So if you are psychologically seeking to become more safe by hiding, like trying to not show up on the radar of the destructive forces, it's actually not a safe strategy. But you can hide, but you're not actually hidden. And so so there's that. Let me say a few things of what I've observed about other traditions other than Christian traditions and how they conceptualize of really smart, harmful, problematic energies, human and otherwise. And then I'll say a few strategies to actually work with it, and then we'll just be in discussion. So one example, I think it's indicative in a generalized way of probably a lot of indigenous systems. So one example I encountered in Buryat Mongol tradition from a friend, Sarah Ngarel, before she passed, is that in Buryat Mongolian shamanism, people talk about the Eastern and Western Tengger. And I believe it's the Western Tengger that are seen as, I'd say more beneficial, but more growth and constructive energy spectrum. And I believe it's the Eastern Tengger that are seen as more destructive or composting, edgier spectrum energies. I believe this would include disease spirits and edgier energies that are associated in a lot of ways with death and less comfortable aspects of life. And the cosmology is affirming very overtly that all of these energies have a place. There's no implication in any way that someone would seek to eliminate a whole category of beings from the universe. So the map includes the destructive forces. In Yoruba cosmology and Ifa tradition, the Ajogun of death, illness, loss, different kinds of human trouble are just part of the infrastructure of the universe. I've never heard anybody suggest that we're going to get rid of the Ajogun or get rid of death or loss or something. The forces may be appeased. They may be, people may try to avoid them or negotiate with them, but they're part of the ecology of the universe. In some of Martin Prechtel's writings, who's heavily shaped by his training with Sutuhil Mayan traditions in Guatemala, speaks eloquently at length about these subjects. But in one of the trainings I did with him, we were making a house for the holies, or an offering, an elaborate kind of shrine offering for the holy mothers of life, something like this. And at one point he was asking us to participate in banishing, basically, or intentionally excluding certain energies that are the energies that would destroy sacred things, and energies of real interference and trouble. And he was very clear that we're not seeking to harm them at all. We're just saying to them, we need you to be anywhere in the universe except for around here and with us at this time. And so the exclusion that is intentionally happening is temporary, and it's relational, and it's honoring of the ones who are being excluded. I've seen it similarly in Lakota tradition, in like Inipi and sweat lodge ceremonies, where there's sometimes the lodge is constructed in a way that is intended to exclude what people might variably describe as coyote or iktomi, or energies that are respected in their sacredness, but not always welcome in all ritual contexts. And so the dangerous energies are ritually engaged directly and intentionally excluded for a time. Other examples, even in Islam, which has a different, you know, the construct of evil in the way that most people probably on the call have encountered it, really comes from middle and later permutations of Christian tradition. And it's one of the traditions that really goes deep into this kind of black and white thinking about it. Even Islam, which can be pretty heavy-handed at times, in Quran, it talks about Iblis as one of the it's different than the shaitan, but as a like a fallen angel. And when Iblis is exiled because God asks for submission or surrender from this one, and he says and he asks him to give reverence and bow to the humans that God has created, and Iblis says, but God, I bow only to you. And so it's a devotion / defiance that is the catalyst for the exile. And so even that is a story of, there's a nuance in it, that it's not all evil or all bad, that there's and some traditions like the Yazidis actually give a lot of reverence to Iblis because of the devotional energy. So short version of all that, we could give examples for another couple hours of different traditions that have a nuanced and ultimately inclusive, or you could say temporarily excluding, strategy for dealing with forces that are quite destructive. Take a breath here. I have a half dozen or so strategies that I've observed that have arisen for me in my practice over the years about how to deal with energies that are seeking to cause harm, whether or not they're conscious of it. And so I'd like to talk through those and notice what questions you have as they arise. So the first is to remember and really take to heart that being a good and loving and honest person does not automatically make you protected from complete doom. You might still be kidnapped and tortured and die slowly, even though you're a good person, really. And maybe that's obvious to, you know, pretty much everybody, but there is a pervasive thought in a lot of spiritual circles that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And it's super like developmentally young, simplistic thinking that can creep into spiritual teachings. And if you really internalize that, it's like you're striving to be the good person so that you're safe and loved and protected, and the powers will favor you. And I think it's important to not pick up that view, partly because it's judgmental toward those who have been eaten by the troubles and lost their lives doing really wholesome work and are being harmed while we're having this call because they've chosen to risk their safety to shift some of these energies. And so sometimes good and ethical people get swallowed up. There's a saying in Zen that the biggest Zen teachers get eaten by the biggest sharks. And so like the more good work you're doing, the more likely you are to get swallowed up, unfortunately. So there's that happy news. The second thing is maybe more of a something to remember than a strategy per se, is that there are really forces that are both smarter and bigger than you are. And it's important to know that you could encounter them. And if you encounter them, you might need to strategically run away from them and hide in order to survive. And I'm not suggesting that at all that one should live in some kind of fearful condition, but it's important in your worldview that you allow for the possibility that not just on a human level, of course that's true, of course governments and groups and individuals even misuse power in a way that overwhelms other groups and individuals, but also on a spiritual level. If you're doing healing work for others, if you're doing ritual work that is outside the bubble of your own immediate life, you might bump into energies, people, spirits, forces that they're bigger than you. They could take you in a fight. They might be bigger and smarter, or one or the other. And if you encounter them and you're working at a different purpose than they are, you need to really assess if you want to have that fight and what are the stakes in losing it. And if you lose it, are you prepared to really go there? Because a lot of healing work, doctoring work from a traditional animist indigenous framework, it's constructed in a relational way. And so if you're going to heal someone, let's say, and they have an intrusive energy around them, and that intrusive energy is smart and strong, and you're about to seek to disentangle it from that person, you are doing the equivalent of taking a fresh deer away from a bear, hungry bear that just killed it. And it's like, you can do that, but don't expect the bear to be happy about it. So again, not to be fearful, but to know that there are times to retreat. And I don't know, that's basic. If you've lived it, it's very basic. But if you haven't lived it, you might notice that it doesn't get talked about much in spiritual circles. And it's the same when people do like magic to, like there was an internet spell to kill Donald Trump or something. And I'm like, oh, people. Like for one, I don't advocate for ethically trying to kill people, I don't think it's ethical to try to kill people in person or in spirit. And I don't think they're really different. And so don't do that. Is that really who you want to be? But also, strategically, do you think this individual is not protected by the system that he's embedded in? And are you prepared to actually take on that entire system? Is that how you want to spend your day energetically? Like, all the physical structures and beings and people have a unseen or subtle reflection in spirit. And so what you see might be deceiving. It might seem simple or not complicated, and then you try to alter it and realize it's part of, it's the visible face of a much more complicated system. So like that. Another strategy is to really appreciate the folks who are on what I would consider the front lines of this type of engagement. That might not be you. That's totally fine. There are folks whose practice it is to engage the forces in the physically visible world that are quite destructive, and the forces on a spirit level that are quite destructive, and sometimes a bit of both. And you don't have to be that person. But if you're not that person and you meet someone who is, say thanks. Thanks for the work you're doing. It's helpful. And understand that there's a role for just giving supportive witness to people who are doing that kind of work. Yeah. A few more thoughts here, and then I do want to encourage questions. I know some people typed just a few questions, but yeah, so keep them coming if they are arising. It's such a multi-layered big topic with lots of implications. It's more interesting for me to respond to what you all have here. Another thought is that community, somebody asked me about skinwalkers. I don't know. That sounds like a Diné or Navajo Southwest thing. I don't know about them specifically in that cultural context. The community justice is ideally not enacted by the people who have been harmed by the whatever it is. We don't have, we have the legal system, but the legal system is terrible, terrible about dehumanizing and objectifying people, not to mention the embedded racism and classism and all the just ways in which the legal system has got big issues. But the point here is that if somebody acts harmfully in community, ideally there is something to the equivalent of a council of elders that can step in and hold that person to account in a way that is objective and fair. The traditions of accountability in a lot of tribal cultures, many of which are still functioning, aim to do this because you can't, it's a very extreme punishment to exile someone. And many tribal cultures would sooner give someone a quick return to spirit than exile them from the community, meaning execution. When I was saying like someone earns himself a quick return. To give one example, in Yoruba culture and Ogboni society, if someone is called before elders and they've acted in a way that really is warranting execution, as I understand it, it's the role of the same elders, that same society within the larger culture, to make sure that they don't become a ghost. So you don't just kill people and dump them in the woods. You, if they warrant it, in this system, but see the underlying principle, whether or not you're in favor of capital punishment, that when a person is killed by the elders, they are also ancestralized. They are assisted to join the ancestors, and they have paid with their life. And so they get to now become a well-seated ancestor in the community. And so if you conceptualize of identity, not just in terms of one lifetime, the execution is a gift that allows them to continue to be part of the community. Tibetans see it similar, generalizing here, knowing that there are rich traditions of assassination in Tibetan Buddhism. Some people like to idealize the Tibetans, oh, they're so cute, they're so enlightened and everything, but and they are cute and probably often enlightened. However, they also do sometimes kill one another on purpose, like many humans. And sometimes when that happens in a systematic rather than a reactive way, it's because it's seen as an act of kindness to prevent someone from continuing to generate such atrocious karma in this lifetime. And so it's a little bit of a tangent, I suppose, but the original point is that justice and fairness aims for inclusion and keeping community together when at all possible. And if someone is deemed such a hazard that they are not able to be returned to community, they are returned to community sometimes traditionally through being executed, because their existence does not stop with the death of the body. And it's sometimes assessed to be the most efficient way to weave them back in. Right. I'm not suggesting we go there with our current criminal justice system, for the record. It is not fair enough to do it that way or spiritually savvy enough. And most of the time, I don't think it's a good choice. So another, I see some of the private questions. They're interesting. I may not engage all of them right now, but thank you for the folks chiming in. A few more points, and then we'll be in dialogue more. If you want to do work, and this is perhaps the most important point, if you want to do work with energies that most people would see as quite harmful energies, let's say sexual predators, for example, people who really, clearly are in that camp and are being harmful toward others and not respecting boundaries. Let's say you wish to assist with that in some way. So you could perhaps work within the system as a counselor or something like that. But if you're going to work with any kind of energy in a skillful healing capacity, it's my bias that you need to be able to enter empathically. Empathically isn't a complete enough word, but I'll circle back to it. You want to be able to empathically enter the experience of that being without judgment, if you can. And if you can't try on the world through their eyes, if they have eyes, then you're not qualified to engage them much or in a much more limited capacity, because you're likely to objectify them and come with judgment and do further harm or enact a kind of, one of the most aggressive things you can do is negate the existence of another being. And one of the ethics that's encapsulated in a very succinct phrase in Lakota tradition is of interrelatedness, of mitakwiyasam. So people say, okay, we're all related, we're all relatives. They're not saying we're all relatives except for really annoying people and most white people and some other arrogant people who we don't like. They're saying, no, really, we're all deeply related. Some of our relatives may be dangerous. They might be a pain in the ass. We may choose not to even talk to them. Or we may go to war with them, or we may relate with them in all kinds of ways. We might even kill them on purpose at times. However, it doesn't negate the relatedness. If you're going to fight with another being, it's possible to fight without objectifying that being. The depersonification or the diminishing of their personhood is a really distasteful kind of aggression. And it's the closest thing, perhaps, in my worldview to something like a sin, is to fail to inhabit a commitment to interdependence by respecting the autonomy and will and existence of others, and instead collapsing into a projecting your worldview onto them that says, I exist more than you do. And so if you're in that place with any given group of people, let's say you just can't really see waspy, straight, judgy, older, white, Southern Republicans as full human beings, because they just make you so crazy politically, and it's hard to just not want them to go far away. Then that's not your work. Don't work with them. You're not equipped to do it. Step away and thank the people who are doing that work, and keep your judgy opinions to your inside voice if you can, because it's not cute. Even among spiritual, I mean, you can say shit when you're in private, I suppose, but ultimately it's not that awesome to basically say to another being, you don't fully exist, because my worldview is so much more correct than yours. So you've kind of become that thing that you don't really want to be in that moment. So the invitation part of that is, if you're going to try to inhabit a non-dual or mystical or it's all one man kind of worldview, which it is, then it means being able to try on the experience of destructive energies. And that's edgy. You want to do it carefully. You don't necessarily want to channel them on strong drugs or whatever, but it's good to know. If you want to know, it's good to know what power over and abuse of that energy would feel like. I'm not saying you do it, but it's good to know the place in you that would abuse power, that would abuse any specific kind of energy, to know the thrill that some people might have hunting humans and stalking them and killing them. Again, not saying that you should hang out in those energies, but if you want to expand your flexibility of consciousness and to diminish the amount of judgment you would have, then understand that these are other just kinds of beings and ways of being that exist in the world, and that just judging them isn't going to eliminate them, right? So that's my plug for recognizing kindly your limitations and being like, wow, that's not a kind of energy I can work with. As a therapist, I've sat with people, not a ton, but some, who really would qualify for a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, which is clinically what people tend to mean when they say a sociopath. And it's uncomfortable a bit for me. It's not a population I wish to work with. But really seeing that, oh, this person has really like structurally low levels of empathy. It's a, somebody's saying there's a kitten behind me. I believe it. There are people in the world who are really sociopathic by whatever name. And you might see that as a dehumanizing kind of judgment. I'm using it more as a description here to say that those individuals would not be appropriate to expect them to be different than they are being in the moment. And so, and many of them are born to loving parents. And so some, we would say in Yoruba tradition, they have oriburuku, is a bad head. It's like they come into the world with a conflicted energy. So some people are just like that. Okay, what do we do with that? Tricky. Last two thoughts, and then let's be in dialogue if we can. Again, the questions are great. Two other things is, know that not every battle is your battle, of course. Like, know when it's for you to touch a situation and when it is really for you to not touch it. Facebook's a great training ground for this. And when to comment and when to shut your face and just not even hit any of the keys on the keyboard. And to notice, like, typically if you comment when you are, it's really not well for you to do that. It's not your destiny, if you will, to put that comment out there. You tend to know it within the next hour or two based on how it plays out. And there are other times when it's good to speak up, and it's a lot of trial and error with that. But there is a kind of protection in doing your very best to know on a soul level, this is my work, this is not my work. I'm not saying that if you're doing your work, you'll be inherently protected, but I do think that the spirits are more likely to back you if you're where you need to be, and that things are generally more likely to go well, because your own, we call it your Ari, but your own kind of soul, I guess, and the powers that are spiritually around you are more apt to undercut you if you're not where you need to be. And so if you're fighting a battle that's not really your place to fight, you're more vulnerable. So know when it's your time to intervene and when it isn't. And finally, it's important to hold the real long-term strategy for things. If you, when I say long-term strategy, I mean over many lifetimes as well. There are some beings that are just not going to locate their heart chakra in this incarnation, or they're just not going to figure out how to do relationship well, or how to have good politics, or have the right view, or whatever. They're not going to figure it out in this life. They might not figure it out in the next few. But if you are not holding the long-term view, you could, we just get a lot more skillful, or a lot less skillful, rather, when we're not holding a long-term view. Because the picture of the being that we're relating with might be, oh, this, you know, this person might live 60, 70, 80 years, but then they'll be gone. They're not actually going to be gone, you know? All the old white segregationist men in the South, for example, who are dying off. Well, hopefully some of the older ones, right? Even the way I say it there, to catch it, is like, sure, they, their bodies might die, but the thing animating them, it doesn't just go away. So how we approach other beings is really ideally guided by a long multiple lifetime strategy. And that calls for slowing way down. And like, wow, most importantly, what is my specific work here? I think I better focus on that and not policing the world, right? And so, unless it's your job to police the world. And so an even more committal way to frame the long-term strategy is from the sort of unitive or non-dual, if you will, frame, which is one true lens and not the only true lens. Others who are being harmful, it's as if they're a limb on your body or vice versa. So when someone is acting, let's say, to deny health care to millions of people, theoretically, you might ask, why would I choose to do this? Why am I choosing to do this? The face of my larger body that is Mitch McConnell, why is it behaving in this way that seems so strange to me? And it's a more intimate way to ask, and a more committed way to ask why, what the role is, what your angle is to potentially leverage a better outcome. But the spirit is one of interconnection, or even oneness in a sense, rather than bad other people outside me should be better so I can relax. And it just, we don't get good outcomes in that way. Not so much. So it I want to wrap up and make sure I'm making space here. I see the Uro, your comment is a little long, so I'm not sure if I'm able to engage it specifically, but there's a lot of folks on the call. So type in, if you would, a question from anybody that you think might have group relevance from anything we've talked about. In summary, from my side, before I look to the comments, there's no quick, easy answer to the really smart, destructive forces in the universe. They're our family members. They're our kin. We've been them. At times, we are them. And they warrant inclusion, which might include having boundaries with them. I'm not saying we don't have boundaries. I'm certainly not saying that. But we seek to hold a framework that doesn't ultimately exclude any aspect of what is, because we do harm to ourselves if we do that as well. Let me go to some of the comments here. Someone speaking to feeling dark forces around them from their childhood. And if you feel really troubled energies around you, so best ways to protect against spiritual attacks. And so this is a almost there. Hold on. Yeah. Okay. Different questions. Good. If you have troubled energies around you, it's important to do whatever work you need to do to shift that. That often, but not always, includes a combination of psychological maturation and healing to cause your energy body and your psyche to be less quick to call in external energies that match your own unintegrated shadow stuff. So sometimes getting in touch with your own anger, fear, confusion, power tripping, like your crazies that you like to push away, will get claiming those aspects of what you are and seeking to integrate them will tend to call in less outside you troubling spirit energies. Strengthening your own connection with your healthy ancestors, other guides, teachers, etc., and having them around you as a kind of beneficial cloud of support can help. And going to trusted people who are more developed in some way than you and saying, hey, there are these pervasive, troubling energies. I'm not sure how to shake them. I'm not sure what to befriend and what to seek to banish. Can be a good way to do it. It's problematic to think that we can work this out only in isolation. And sometimes if folks have experienced trauma or abuse from a young age or whenever really, but it's especially impactful when it's young and it's from someone that is close to us, sometimes the one enacting that harm is also a channel for other than human, otherworldly kinds of badness. And there can be the feeling of getting a kind of vampire bite or snake bite or something that's persistent and hard to just resolve psychologically from that boundary violation. And so sometimes there can be a benefit to bringing any kind of spiritual framework that can handle it to that trouble and asking what's the antidote here for the way in which I still feel linked to that otherworldly energy that came into my space in a not okay way. And so sometimes folks have contact with, again, I don't want to call them evil, but opportunistic, fear-eating, non-loving spirit energies that leave a lasting imprint. It's like they continue to have access until the underlying wound is addressed. So it can be like that. So reach out for support to the person who sent me the comment. I'm wondering, it was private, so I don't want to name you. But reach out for support on that. Saskia is asking, do you, how to invite constructive conversation without going you versus me in a polarized way? I had this great conversation on the airplane back from Nigeria. I'm like, it's altered. It's like a week and a half ago. I just spent 2 weeks in ritual in West Africa. And then I'm talking to this young guy who's totally like, he's a, Jews for Jesus person. I don't know the right name for him, but I think that's how he described himself. And Presbyterian, both. And he was just in Israel. He was very passionate about defending the politics of Israel and, Messianic Judaism. And I was given a lot of opportunities sitting next to him on the plane to be very patient and to try on my patient pants and just not be a jerk back. And I was able to do it. And, but it was a stretch. And it was, what I was being reminded of in the moment is that I'm accountable to him, for one, and that if I want to be a spiritual grown-up, my speech is one of my primary tools. And if I'm not using my speech to bless or enrich in some way others or those interacting with me, then I should keep my mouth shut unless I'm willing to use my speech in that way. Because to use it just to vent or to dig in, I mean, I push back on him some, but I would regulate in the conversation. And to use speech just to harm or to objectify or to just project anger, I'm not saying it's always bad. I'm not tone policing. I'm not saying you can't feel anger. I'm saying if you want to be a powerful wizard or witch or magical person, your speech is important. And you can kill people with your words. You can bless them with your words. You need to be responsible with your speech. And the deeper you spiral into initiatory work, the more true that is. And the more true, like, you can't just wish harm to people with your speech. Because then if you have the backing of the spirit, sometimes it has that effect. And then that's on you. You did that. So just hold them in a kind light and assess for if there's any openness. You know, I don't think there's one easy strategy for how to invite constructive conversation besides try to accurately listen and reflect back their worldview in a way that helps them to feel even more like surprisingly well seen by you. If you want people to listen to you and to care what you have to say, you have to listen very carefully to them and reflect back to them very accurately where they're coming from. And typically, if you can do that, people will be like, okay, I feel heard. I'm ready to listen to you. So that's a general strategy. There's a question, how to work with someone who feels they've been cursed. It's hard to give a general answer besides to say that validate how they feel. They may actually be cursed. That can mean a lot of things. They probably haven't experienced an old school, like, indigenous, tribal, shamanic, well-planted curse, but they might have, because those also happen. It's probably more of a psychological trauma / spirit intrusion / self-imposed bad word spell, but either way, it can function as a block to thriving. And so I would say, as a general strategy, if someone tells you feel like they've been cursed, to validate them and help them to know that there are people who deal with that. And so when they're ready to be not cursed, they should seek out someone who knows how to deal with curses and ideally has a psychology background too. So curses are real things. Someone's asking, how to protect against spiritual attacks. I feel like we kind of said that a bit already. It's tricky having experienced that. For one, try not to make enemies with spiritually powerful, aggressive people, because they will light your shit up if they want to, and that's no fun. And the other thing is, if that is really happening, hire someone who's above their pay grade to stop it if you need to. Take it seriously. I'm not saying you hire someone to like zap them, but you, if someone's coming at you with offensive magic and they're actually doing that, or they just have loud, witchy, dart-like thoughts, which is functionally kind of the same thing, then you need protection and defensive magic that's stronger than them. So, yeah, bump it up the chain until you find someone who's got the capacity to help you. I mean, do the usual things. If they don't work, then who are these people to refer to for that? I contract out to my elders in West Africa when needed. But talk to me. I mean, there are people who do such things. And yeah, there are ways. So thanks. Another question, how to help protect children from evil, bad, harmful spirits? It's a good and relevant question. You want to have the caregivers and people around them make sure that they're spiritually well, and make sure that the ancestors of the child are proactively supporting them, and make sure that the home itself is a safe and energetically clear environment. And just listening intuitively and making space to listen to your dreams and to your intuitive sense of things will cause many kinds of trouble that could happen to show up on the radar. And the more you can know about a child's destiny, the better. At least from a Yoruba perspective, we do a Esentaye or a Kosajaye in a few days after a child's born, where there's a reading to get the taboos and prescriptions for the early phase and potentially beyond of a person's life. And so that can include food taboos, things to do, things, you know, all kinds of things to do, not to do. But the spirit of that is that the elders and the system of Ifa is trying to pinpoint, what does this specific soul need in order to thrive? And are there things that would function at cross purposes to their thriving that need eliminated from their environment? And it's not that different from if someone discovers that their child has a food allergy, from at least from a Yoruba perspective, it's just one example of a West African indigenous system. The view is that it's like a taboo. It's like, oh yes, they have a peanut taboo or whatever. So, yeah. So seek to understand what the child needs, even if they're pre-verbal. And there are ways to do that through intuitive consultations, readings, trusting your dreams, tuning in, just asking your own ancestors, but ask the question. Yeah. Someone asked, do you think it's possible to love our evil so much that it becomes love on a collective level too? Our evil, I think you mean evil, so to speak, destructive forces in the world. Yes. It's possible, yes. And it's possible to walk in an open-hearted way into a field of destructive energies and just get swallowed up too. Be like, damn, bad timing. But it's also possible to have just the right conditions in the right moment where those beings are ready to shift. And what's important to know is that love doesn't always look kind. Love can look like execution. From a more complete kind of worldview. And it can look like letting someone die who wants to die. And it can look like um, loving someone so much that you don't interfere with the natural consequences of their choices, that you help them to learn through having their karma ripen sooner more than later, so they can move through that cycle of difficulty. I'm not trying to be like, go kill the bad guys or something. I hope you don't take that away from it. But what I'm saying is death is a change of station. It's not an end. It's a point on a much, much larger, more complicated cycle. And so loving the destructive energies totally is the way to go. Even more than, it's like the shoulder loves the elbow, loves the hand. I want to say it's almost like beyond love. It's a surrendering to the inseparability of things. And so from that stance, the question is what's the appropriate expression of love and just instinctual knowing? There's a great koan, how does Avalokiteshvara keep track of all those many arms? Because she's seen as the manifestation of compassion and grows all these extra arms to assist even more beings out of devotion. And so the question's given to the proverbial Zen student of like, how is this being keeping track of all those arms? And one of the answers it's given is lovely in a way that Zen tradition can be, is like adjusting a pillow in the night. And so the sense is if you're dropped in, you're really dropped in, you'll know what to do. You know what love looks like in the moment. Yeah. Let me look to one of their comments. Some of them are private comments here, but they're interesting. So we'll finish up in just a minute. So it's good how to discern if a less well energy that's coming to you is a psychic attack versus a request to help. And sometimes it's both. And what's important is to ask, are you willing to help? Is it your role in karma to help? Do you have the training to help in a way that's still good for you? Because if you hang up a sign in the spirit world that says, troubled ghosts, come here, free help, you're going to be a busy, busy person. And you may not have a lot of you're not going to have a long lifespan if you take it just like that. Sometimes people will, like in white table work, as I understand it, or some of the spiritist traditions in Brazil, they'll set up a certain time. It's like every Wednesday from 2 to 4, all the troubled, tormented souls in the universe are welcome to form a line outside this building, and we're going to bless you and blast you into the light in a good way, one at a time. And we'll be done at 4 o'clock. Sorry, we'll be back next week. So if you want to do that work and you have the training and you really want to be available for it, create a structure around it. It's like, I will feed the demons diligently one day a week here only. And if you get out of line, you're going to not get fed anymore. But this is all I got. So, because otherwise it gets out of hand. Like, and it'll, yeah. That's good. Thanks, Laura. Any recommendations on the type of training? Yeah. Contact me directly. Give me a call. The training that I do, what I'm focused on is helping to work with the dead, the human dead, because a lot of the porousness in our energy body that lets in otherworldly kinds of badness is a function of ancestral damage that causes us to not be as fortified as we could be. When we're really ancestrally vibrant and fortified, then a lot of the, it's like we no longer have a compromised immune system, spiritually speaking. And so a lot of the opportunistic spiritual infections aren't going to find us. So you get really physically well and spiritually well with your ancestors, and it resolves a whole list of problems that otherwise, you know, would be actual problems because you don't have the resilience. So So that's what I'm focused on. It's just one piece of the picture, but it's where my focus is. Last question, and we'll need to finish here. Simplest best way to clear negative energy from a home? How would I answer that succinctly? My basic go-to formula is there anything that is in this home that ideally is not here? So that's the clearing part. You can use, depending on how big it is, the problem is you can use sage or blessed water or sound or different kind of scented oils or intent. So many different ways to achieve it, but you shake up the energy and shake it out, basically. I mean, and there are some things where sage just isn't enough, but so if you can clear things from your space, then the next level of that is to call in whatever needs to be there. Like, I see work with a home much like work with a person. Is there any work energy that needs removed from their space because it's not them? And then is there any energy that needs called back because it was missing? And then how to harmonize that now intact energy with the environment around it. So what's the relationship of the spirits of the land where the home is at? You can't consider the health energetically of a home only in terms of the humans that inhabit it. There needs to be consideration of the land and the spirits of place as well, even if you're in a big city. So that's a generalized answer. It's like, all right, actual last question. Any suggestions when it's appropriate to retreat and when are you just cowardly retreating to your love bunker? Great. Sorry, I said that, didn't I? The best spiritual protection is to have wise, kind people around you who you trust to call you out on your shit. Because we can't always know. I have done a fair amount of work on myself, and I do ritual stuff full-time. And I check in a lot with people around me with divination. And I double, triple check things. Maybe more than I need to, but I don't want to mess up. And so find at least two or three different ways to cross-check a situation. Good people around you, listen to your dreams, bring it to the spirits that you work with. And really, I think it's good to move slow in the world and methodical and deliberate and to really check things out. And so if you're doing that, you're not going to get too deep in the weeds. Do that and just fiercely commit to a lifelong path of growth, even if it scares you, which it should. And you won't have a lot of unnecessary suffering. So thanks everybody for your time. I know it's kind of a big rambly topic, but be friendly to the destructive powers. They need love too. I should say that I have a book coming out this next few weeks. I'm very happy about that. It's been 9 years to get that all cooked up and published and everything. So you probably know my website if you're on here, but I'll type it in here just in case. Let me stop this recording. Okay.